crammed to the rafters with odorous humanity. These lay in small snuggled heaps on the floor near the hearth, or on pallets by the far wall. And here and there, tousled heads poked up like prairie dogs, blinking in the glow of the smoured fire to see what was to do. Their host, introduced by Fraser as Angus McLaren, nodded curtly to Roger, and gestured toward a bedstead drawn into the centre of the room. Two or three small children were sleeping on it, but Roger could just make out the blur of Buck's face on the pillow.
Christ, he hoped Buck didn't have anything contagious.
He leaned in close, whispering,
"Buck,"
so as not to wake anyone who hadn't waked already. He couldn't make out much of Buck's face in the gloom, and it was covered with beard stubble as well, but his eyes were closed, and he didn't open them in response to Roger's saying his name, nor in response to Roger's laying a hand on his arm. The arm did feel warm, but given the suffocating atmosphere in the cottage, he thought it likely Buck would feel warm even if he'd been dead for hours. He squeezed the arm, lightly at first, then harder, and at last Buck gave a strangled cough and opened his eyes. He blinked slowly, not seeming to recognize Roger, then closed them again. His chest heaved visibly, though, and he breathed now with a slow, clearly audible, gasping note.
"He says as there's something the matter with his heart," McLaren told Roger, low-voiced.
He was leaning over Roger's shoulder, watching Buck intently.
"It flutters like, and when it does, he goes blue and canna breathe or stand up. My second eldest lad found him out in the heather yesterday afternoon, flat as a squashed toad. We fetched him down and gave him a bit to drink, and he asked would we send someone to Lallybroch to ask after his kinsman."
"Morin, Teich," said Roger. "I'm not obliged to you, sir."
He turned to Brian, who was lurking behind McLaren, looking at Buck with a small frown.
"And I thank you too, sir," Roger said to him, "for all your help. I can't thank you enough."
Fraser shrugged, dismissing this.
"I'll imagine you'll stay with him, eh? If he's able to travel in the morn, bring him along to Lallybroch, or send if there's aught we can do."
Fraser nodded to McLaren in farewell, but then paused, squinting through the murk at Buck's face. He glanced at Roger, as though comparing their features.
"Is your kinsman from Lochalsh as well?"
he asked, curious, and looked back at Buck.
"He's the look of my late wife's people about him. The Mackenzies of Leoch."
Then he noticed the small, squat shape of what must be Mrs. McLaren, glowering under her cap, and he coughed, bowed, and took his leave without waiting for an answer. Mr. McLaren went to bolt the door, and the lady of the house turned to Roger, yawned cavernously, then motioned toward the bed, scratching her bottom unself-consciously.
"You can sleep wi' him," she said. "Push him out the bed if he dies, aye? I dinna want my quilts all spoilt."
Having taken off his boots, Roger lay down gingerly on the quilt beside Buck, readjusting the position of the small children, who were limp and flexible as cats in sunshine, and spent the remainder of the night listening to his ancestor's irregular snoring, poking him whenever it seemed to stop. Toward dawn, though, he dozed off, to be wakened some time later by the thick, warm smell of porridge. Alarmed by the fact that he'd fallen asleep, he raised up on one elbow to find Buck, pale-faced, and breathing stertorously through his mouth. He seized his ancestor by the shoulder and shook him, causing Buck to start up in bed, glaring wildly round. Spotting Roger, he punched him solidly in the stomach.
"Bugger off with that! I just wanted to be sure you were alive, you bastard. What are you doing here in the first place?"
Buck rubbed a hand through his dishevelled hair, looking cross and confused.
"You sent for me, fool."
Roger was cross, too. His mouth felt as though he'd been chewing straw all night.
"How are you, anyway?" "Not that well."
Buck's face changed abruptly from crossness to a pale apprehension, and he put a hand flat on his chest, pressing hard.
It doesn't feel right. Lie down, for God's sake.
Roger squirmed off the bed, narrowly avoiding stepping on a little girl who was sitting on the floor playing with the buckles of his boots.
Give you some water.
A row of children was watching this byplay with interest, ignored by Mrs. McLaren and two of the older girls, who were respectively stirring a huge cauldron of porridge and rapidly laying the large table for breakfast, slapping down wooden plates and spoons like cards in a game of old maid.
"If you need the privy," one of the girls advised him, pausing in her rounds, "you'd best go now. Robbie and Sandy've gone to tend the kine, and Stuart's no got his shoon on yet."
She lifted her chin toward a stripling of 12 or so, who was crawling slowly about on hands and knees with one worn shoe in one hand, peering under the sparse furniture in search of its mate.
"Oh, and since your kinsman's lived the night, Da's gone for the healer."
Chapter 36. The Scent of a Stranger. She had brought Jock McLeod the traditional hospital present of grapes and a bottle of 18-year-old Boonahaven, which had brightened his face, or what could be seen of it behind the bandage that wrapped his head, and the bruising that narrowed both eyes to bloodshot slits.
"Oh, I'm a bit peely, Wally,"
he told her, wrapping the bottle in his dressing gown and handing it to her to stash in his bedside cabinet.
"But no bad, no bad. A wee dunt on the head is all. I'm only glad the lad got away. D'ye ken how he came to be in the tunnel, lass?"
She'd given him the official version, listened patiently to his speculations, and then asked if he'd maybe recognised the man who'd hit him.
"Well, I did then,"
Jock had said, surprising her. He leaned back on his pillows.
"Which is not to say as I know his name, but I've seen him, often. He skippers a boat on the canal."
"What? A charter boat? Or one of the Jacobite cruise boats?" Her heart beat faster. The Caledonian Canal, he meant. It ran from Inverness to Fort William and carried a huge amount of water traffic, much of it visible from the road.
"Nice wee motor sealer. Must be a charter. I only noticed because my wife's cousin has one like it. We went out wi' him the once. 10 metre, I think it is."
"You told the police, of course?"
"I did so."
He tapped blunt fingers on the coverlet, glancing sideways at her.
"I described the man so well as I could, but Ken, it didn't really look unusual. I'd know him again, and maybe your wee lad would, but I don't know as the police would pick him out easy."
She'd brought her Swiss Army knife out of her pocket as she talked, playing with it meditatively, flicking the blades open and shut. She opened the corkscrew, testing the sharp end of it with the ball of her thumb.
"Do you think you could maybe describe him to me?
I draw a bit. I can make a stab at a picture."
He grinned at her, eyes disappearing into the bruised flesh.
"Pour me a dram, lass, and we'll have a go."
Brianna reached Lallybroch again in the late afternoon, just in time for her 4 o'clock appointment with the locksmith. A scrap of white tacked to the door fluttered in the autumn wind. She yanked it off and fumbled it open with chilled fingers.
"Had an emergency call in Elgin. Won't be back till late. We'll call by in the morning. Apologies, Will Tranter."
She crumpled the note and stuffed it into her jacket pocket, muttering under her breath,
"Bloody kidnapping rapist bastards walking in and out of her house like it was the public highway and this wasn't an emergency."
She hesitated, fingers wrapped around the big antique key in her pocket, looking up at the white hulled front of the house. The sinking sun flashed in the upper windows, glazing them with red, hiding whatever might be behind them. They had a key. Did she really want to go in there alone? She glanced round, self-conscious, but saw nothing out of the ordinary. The home fields lay tranquil, the small flock of sheep already bedding down in the setting sun. She breathed deeply, turning from side to side as she would when hunting with Dar in the North Carolina forest, as though she might catch the tang of deer on the breeze. What was she looking for now? Exhaust fumes, rubber, hot metal, unlaid dust in the air, the ghost of a car? Or maybe something else, she thought, remembering the stink of Rob Cameron's sweat. The scent of a stranger. But the cold air brought her only the smell of dead leaves, sheep shit, and a hint of turpentine from the Forestry Commission's pine plantation to the west. Still. She'd heard her father mention a feeling at the back of his neck when something was wrong, and she felt the hairs on her nape prickle now. She turned away, got back into her car, and drove off, glancing automatically behind her every few minutes. There was a petrol station a few miles up the road. She stopped there to call Fiona and say she'd pick the kids up in the morning. Then bought a few snacks and drove back, taking the farm track that circled the far edge of Lallybroch's land and led up into the pine plantation. At this time of year, it got dark by 4:30 p.m. Up the hillside, the track was no more than a pair of muddy ruts, but she bumped carefully along until she came to one of the clearings where the foresters' piled slash were burning. The air was rough with the smell of wood fire, and a big blackened patch of earth and ember still sent up wisps of smoke. But all the fires were out. She drove the car behind a heap of fresh-cut branches, piled ready for the next day, and cut the ignition. As she came down out of the plantation, carrying the shotgun in one hand, something large shot past her head in total silence, and she stumbled, gasping. An owl. It disappeared, a pale blur in the dark. In spite of her pounding heart, she was glad to see it. White animals were harbingers of good luck in Celtic folklore. She could use any luck going.
Owls are keepers of the dead, but not just the dead. They're messengers between worlds.
For an instant, Roger was next to her, solid, warm in the cold night, and she put out a hand by impulse as though to touch him. Then he was gone, and she was standing alone in the shadow of the pines, looking toward Lallybroch, the shotgun cold in her hand.
"I'll get you back, Roger," she whispered under her breath,
and curled her left hand into a fist, clenching the copper ring with which he'd married her.
"I will."
But first, she had to make sure the kids were safe. Night rose up around the house, and Lallybroch faded slowly out of sight, a paler blotch against the dark. She checked the safety on the gun and moved silently toward home. She came up the hill behind the broch as quietly as she could. The wind had come up, and she doubted anyone would hear her steps over the rustling of the gorse and rye broom that grew thick back here. If they were waiting for her, wanting to do harm, surely they'd be in the house. But if they just wanted to know where she was, they might be watching the house instead, and this was the place to do it from. She paused by the wall of the broch and put a hand on the stones, listening. Faint rustling, punctuated by an occasional dovish coo. The bats would have gone out long since hunting, but the doves were abed. Pressing her back against the stones, she sidled around the broch, pausing near the door, and reached out a hand, groping for the latch. The padlock was cold in her hand, intact and locked. Letting out her breath, she fumbled the bunch of keys out of her pocket and found the right one by touch. The sleeping doves erupted in a mad flutter when the wind from the open door whooshed up to the rafters where they roosted, and she stepped hastily back against the wall, out of the way of a pattering rain of panicked incontinence. The doves calmed in a moment, though, and settled down again in a murmurous rustle of indignation at the disturbance. The upper floors had long since fallen in, and the timbers cleared away. The broch was a shell, but a sturdy shell, its outer stones repaired over the years. The stair was built into the wall itself, the stone steps leading up between the inner and outer walls, and she broke the gun over her shoulder and went up slowly, feeling her way one-handed. There was a torch in her pocket, but no need to risk using it. A third of the way up, she took up station by a window slit that commanded a view of the house below. It was cold sitting on the stones, but her jacket was down-filled and she wouldn't freeze. She pulled a bar of violet crumble from her pocket and settled down to wait. She'd called the hydro board and asked for a week's leave in order to deal with a family emergency. News of what had happened at the Loch Eochtee Dam last night had spread, so there'd be no difficulty, save in deflecting the flood of sympathetic exclamations and curious questions, all of which she claimed not to be able to answer, owing to the ongoing police inquiry. The police. They might be of help. Jock had told them about the man at the dam. They'd be following that up. She'd had to tell them about Rob Cameron. And with some reluctance, she told them about his coming into the house and threatening her, since Mandy would likely blow the gaff about that. She told them about his open disgruntlement over having a woman supervisor and his harassing her at work, though that seemed like a paltry motive for kidnapping a child. She hadn't mentioned most of the physical stuff, the priest's hall, or Cameron's assisted escape, though. Just said she'd hit him first with the letterbox and then with a cricket bat, and he'd run away. She'd gone with Mandy to find Jem, that being obviously more urgent than calling the police. The police didn't agree with that assessment, but they were British, and thus polite about their disapproval. She'd said Cameron had told her where Jem was. If the police found him, he wasn't going to be in any position to contradict her. She did hope they picked him up. It might cause complications, but she'd feel safer if he wasn't wandering around loose. With her rifle. Possibly lurking in her house. Her hand curled up in the deep pocket of her jacket, fingering the comforting shapes of a dozen shotgun shells. Chapter 37 Cognus Cote. The healer arrived in mid-afternoon. He was a short man, but not slight. He looked like an amateur wrestler, with shoulders nearly as broad as Roger's own. He didn't introduce himself, but nodded politely to Mrs. McLaren, his eyes flicking round the room in a brief, all-encompassing glance, then focused on Buck, who had fallen into an uneasy sleep, and didn't wake even to the disturbance caused by the healer's entrance.
"He says his heart,"
Roger began awkwardly. The man glanced sharply sideways at him, and then flicked a hand in dismissal, and, walking over, peered closely at Buck for a moment. All the McLarens waited in breathless silence, clearly expecting something spectacular. The man nodded to himself, removed his coat, and turned back his shirt sleeves, displaying sun-browned forearms corded with muscle.
"Well, then,"
he said, sitting down by the bed and laying a hand on Buck's chest.
"Let me..."
His face went quite blank, and he stiffened, his hand jerking back as though he'd received an electric shock. He gave a quick, hard shake of the head and pulled Buck's shirt open, plunging both hands into the opening and laying them flat on Buck's laboring chest.
"Jesu," he whispered, "cognosco te."
Quite suddenly the hairs on Roger's body lifted, prickling as though a thunderstorm was coming. The man had spoken in Latin, and what he had said was, "I know you." The McLarens all watched the healer work with great respect and not a little awe. Roger, who had learned a good bit about the psychology of healing from Claire, was just as impressed, and to be frank, scared shitless. The healer had stood motionless for a long moment, hands on Buck's chest, his head thrown back and eyes closed, his face contorted in an expression of the deepest concentration, as though listening to something far, far off. He had murmured what Roger recognized as the Pater Noster. From the looks on the faces of the McLarens, it might as well have been the Abracadabra. Then, keeping his hands in place, he had raised one thick forefinger and begun to tap, delicately, in a slow, regular rhythm, his finger rebounding each time, as though he was striking a piano key. Thup, thup, thup. It went on for a long time, so long that everyone in the room began to draw breath again. Even Buck, whose laboured gasping began to ease, his lungs filling naturally again. Then it was two fingers, sup-tup, sup-tup, sup-tup. Slow, regular as a metronome, on and on and on and on, soothing, hypnotic. And Roger realized that the rhythm was that of a beating heart, his own heart. Looking round the room at the wide eyes and slightly open mouths of the adenoidal McLaren clan, he had the most peculiar sense that all their hearts were beating to precisely the same rhythm. He knew they were breathing as one. He could hear the susurrus of indrawn breath and the seafoam rush of exhalation. He knew it, and was helpless to change his own rhythm, to resist the sense of unity that had formed insensibly among all the people in the cabin, from Angus McLaren down to little Josephine, round-eyed as the rest in her mother's arms. All of them were breathing, hearts beating as one, and somehow they were supporting the stricken man, holding him as part of a larger entity, embracing him. Bracing him. Buck's injured heart lay in the palm of Roger's hand. He realized it quite suddenly, and just as suddenly realized that it had been there for some time, resting as naturally in the curve of his palm as rounded river rock, smooth and heavy, and beating in time with the heart in Roger's chest. What was much stranger was that none of this felt in any way out of the ordinary. Odd and impressive as it was, Roger could have explained this. Mass suggestion, hypnosis, will and willingness. He'd done much the same thing himself any number of times, singing, when the music caught the audience up with him, when he knew they were with him and would follow him anywhere. He'd done it once or twice preaching, felt the people warm to him and lift him up as he lifted them. It was impressive to see it done so quickly and thoroughly without any sort of warm-up, though, and much more disquieting to feel the effects in his own flesh. What was scaring him, though, was that the healer's hands were blue. No doubt about it. It wasn't a trick of the light. There wasn't any to speak of, bar the dull glow of the smoured fire. It wasn't a huge thing. No fiery coruscations or neon. But a soft blue tinge had come up between the healer's fingers, crept over the backs of his hands, and now spread in a faint haze around his hands, seeming to penetrate Buck's chest. Roger glanced to one side, then the other, without moving his head. The McLarens were paying rapt attention, but showed no sign of seeing anything startling. "They don't see it." The hairs on his forearms lifted silently. "Why do I see it?" Thup-tup, thup-tup, thup-tup. Tireless, regular. And yet Roger became aware of some subtle change. Not in the healer's rhythm, that didn't vary at all. But something had shifted. He glanced down involuntarily into his palm, where he still imagined that Buck's heart lay, and was now scarcely surprised to see it there, a ghostly, round object, transparent, but pulsing gently, regularly, on its own. Thup-tup. 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 The healer was now following, not leading. Not slowing the beats, but pausing for a longer period between them. Letting Buck's heart beat alone between them. At last the faint sound stopped, and there was silence in the room for the length of 3 heartbeats. And then the silence popped like a soap bubble, leaving the onlookers blinking and shaking their heads as those awakened from dreaming. Roger closed his empty hand.
"He'll be all right," the healer said to Mrs. McLaren in a matter-of-fact manner. "Let him sleep as long as he can. Give him something to eat when he wakes up."
"Much obliged, sir," Mrs. McLaren murmured.
She patted Josephine, who had fallen asleep with her mouth open, a glimmering trail of saliva falling from the corner of her mouth to her mother's shoulder.
"Will it make up a pallet for you by the fire?"
"Ah, no," the healer said, smiling.
He shrugged back into his coat, put on his cloak, and reached for his hat.
"I'm staying no great distance away."
He went out, and Roger waited for a moment, just long enough for people to turn back to their own conversations, and then followed, shutting the door quietly behind him. The healer was a little way down the road. Roger saw the man's dark figure kneeling in prayer before a tiny shrine, the ends of his cloak fluttering in the wind. Roger came up to him slowly, hanging back so as not to disturb his devotions, and, on impulse, bowed his own head toward the small statue, so weathered as to be faceless.
"Take care of them, please," he prayed. "Help me get back to them, to Bree."
That was all he had time for before the healer rose to his feet. But that was all he had to say, in any case. The healer hadn't heard him. He rose and turned, surprised at seeing Roger, but recognizing him at once. He smiled, a little wearily, clearly expecting some medical question of a private nature. Heart thumping, Roger reached out and grasped the healer's hand. The man's eyes widened with shock.
"Cognosco te," Roger said very softly. "I know you." "Who are you, then?"
Dr. Hector McEwen stood squinting against the wind, his face wary but excited.
"The two of you. Who are you?" "I think he maybe can that better than I do,"
Roger told him.
The light in your hands. You could see it."
It wasn't a question, and the wary excitement in McEwen's eyes blazed into life, visible even in the dimming light.
I could. Where did you—"
Roger groped for the best way to ask, but after all, how many ways were there?
"When did you come from?"
McEwen glanced involuntarily over his shoulder toward the croft, but the door was shut, smoke pouring from the hole in the roof. It was beginning to rain, a premonitory pattering among the mounded heather near the path. He moved abruptly, taking Roger's arm.
"Come," he said. "We cannae be standing out here, dreich as it is. We'll catch our deaths."
Dreich was the word. The rain set to in good earnest, and Roger was half-soaked in minutes, having come out without hat or cloak. McEwen led the way quickly up a winding path through thickets of dark gorse, emerging onto a stretch of moorland where the remains of a tumble-down croft offered some shelter. The roof tree had been burned, and recently. The smell still lingered. A corner of thatch remained, though, and they huddled inside, close beneath its scanty protection.
"Anno Domini, 1841, McEwen said matter-of-factly, shaking rain from his cloak.
He looked up at Roger, one thick brow raised.
1980,
Roger replied, heart hammering. He cleared his throat and repeated the date. The cold had affected his throat, and the words emerged in a strangled croak. McEwen leaned close at the sound, peering at him.
"What's that?"
the man asked sharply.
"Your voice. It's broken. It's enough,"
Roger began. But the healer's fingers were already groping behind his head, undoing his neckcloth in nothing flat. He closed his eyes, not resisting. McEwen's broad fingers were cold on his neck. He felt the icy touch delicate on his skin as it traced the line of the rope scar, then firmer as the healer prodded gently around his damaged larynx. It gave him an involuntary choking sensation, and he coughed. McEwen looked surprised.
"Do that again," he said. "What, cough?"
Roger said, hoarse as a crow.
"Aye, that."
McEwen fitted his hand snugly round Roger's neck just under the chin and nodded.
"Once, then wait, then do it again."
Roger hacked obligingly, feeling a slight pain with each expulsion of breath where the healer's hand pressed. The man's face brightened with interest, and he removed his hand.
"Do you know what a hyoid bone is?"
"If I had to guess, it's something in the throat."
Roger cleared his throat hard and rubbed at it, feeling the roughness of the scar under his palm.
"Why?"
He wasn't sure whether to be offended at the personal intrusion or something else. His skin tingled slightly where McEwen had touched it.
"It's just there," the healer said, pressing with his thumb high up under Roger's chin. "And if it had been here," he moved the thumb down an inch, "you'd have been dead, sir. It's a fragile wee bone. Easy to strangle someone by breaking it. With your thumbs. Or a rope."
He drew back a little, eyes intent on Roger's. The curiosity was still plain on his face, but the wariness had returned.
"Are you and your friend fleeing from something? Someone?"
"No."
Roger felt at once very tired, the strain of everything catching up to him, and looked around for something to sit on. There was nothing but a few dark chunks of rock that had fallen from the cottage's wall when the burning thatch had been pulled down. He pushed two blocks together and sat on one, knees up round his ears.
This,
he touched his throat briefly.
"It was a long time ago. Nothing to do with what we're looking for my son. He's only 9.
"Oh, dearie me."
McEwen's broad face creased in sympathy.
"How?"
Roger lifted a hand.
"You first,"
he said, and cleared his throat again.
"I'll tell you everything I know, but you first, please."
McEwen pursed his lips and glanced aside, thinking, but then shrugged and lowered himself, grunting, to his own rude seat.
"I was a doctor," he said abruptly, "in Edinburgh. I came up to the Highlands to shoot grouse with a friend. Do folks still do that 100 years hence?"
"Aye. Grouse are still tasty,"
Roger said dryly.
"It was at Craignadoon that you came through then?"
"Yes, I..."
McEwen halted abruptly, realizing what that question implied.
"Dear Lord in heaven, do you mean to be telling me that there are other places where it happens?"
"Yes."
The hairs rippled on Roger's arms.
4 that I know of. Likely there are others. How many stone circles are there in the British Isles?"
"I've no idea."
McEwen was clearly shaken. He got up and went to the doorway. The jamb of it scorched and the lintel burned almost away. Roger hoped none of the stones above it would fall on the man's head. At least, not until he found out more. Dr. McEwen stayed for a long time, staring out into the rain, which had gone the silvery grey of cat's fur. Finally he shook himself and came back, mouth set in firm decision.
"Aye, nothing to be gained from secrecy, and I hope nothing to be lost by honesty."
This last was not quite a question, but Roger nodded and tried to look earnest.
"Well then, grouse, as I say. We were on the moor, just below that hill where the standing stones are. All of a sudden, a fox shot out of the bracken right by my foot, and one of the dogs lost his head and chased it. Brewer, that was my friend, Joseph Brewer, started after it, but he had
McEwen corrected with an expression of mild irritation that made Roger want to smile, because he was so familiar with the feeling that dealing with the phenomenon caused a club foot. He managed all right with a special boot, but climbing and chasing. He shrugged.
So you went after the dog and...
Roger shuddered involuntarily at the memory, and so did McEwen.
Exactly. Did the dog go?
Roger asked suddenly. McEwen looked surprised and vaguely affronted.
How should I know? It didn't turn up where I did, I can tell you that much.
Roger made a brief gesture of apology.
Just curious. My wife and I, we've been trying to puzzle out as much as we can for the sake of the children.
Children caught in his throat, coming out in no more than a whisper, and McEwen's expression softened.
Aye, of course. Your son, you said.
Roger nodded and managed to explain what he could about Cameron, the letters, and after a moment's hesitation, about the Spaniard's gold. For after all, he'd have to give a reason for Cameron's taking Jem in the first place. And his sense of Dr. McEwen was one of solid kindness.
"Deary me," the doctor murmured, shaking his head in dismay. "I'll ask among my patients. Perhaps someone."
He trailed off, his face still troubled. Roger had the distinct impression that the sense of trouble wasn't all down to Jem, or even to the staggering discovery that there were other... He stopped, seeing plainly in his mind's eye the soft blue glow surrounding McEwen's fingers, and the look of surprised delight on his face.
"Cognosco te. I know you."
Delight, not just shock. He and Buck weren't the first time travellers this man had known. But the doctor hadn't said as much. Why not?
"How long have you been here?"
Roger asked, curious. McEwen sighed and rubbed a hand over his face.
"Maybe too long," he said,
but then pushed that away, straightening up.
"2 years about. Speaking of too long, though..."
He straightened, pulling the cloak over his shoulders.
"It'll be dark in less than an hour. I'll need to go if I'm to reach Cranesmuir by nightfall. I'll come again tomorrow to tend your friend. We can talk a bit more then."
He turned abruptly, but just as suddenly turned back, and reaching out, took Roger's throat in his hand.
"Maybe," he said, as though to himself. "Just maybe."
Then he nodded once, let go, and was gone, his cloak fluttering like bat wings behind him. Chapter 38. The Number of the Beast. After Fraggle Rock, the telly went to the evening news, and Ginger reached to turn it off, but stopped abruptly as Jem's last year's school picture flashed on the screen. She stared at the television, mouth half open, then looked incredulously at Jem.
"That's you," she said.
"Can that fine?" he said crossly. "Turn it off, I."
"No, I want to see."
She blocked him as he lunged for the screen. Ginger was 11 and bigger than him.
"Turn it off," he said.
Then, with cunning inspiration,
"It'll scare Mandy, and she'll howl."
Ginger shot Mandy a quick glance. She had good lungs, did Mandy. Then reluctantly turned the TV off.
"Mm-hmm," she said, and lowered her voice. "Mam told us what happened, but she said we weren't to trouble you about it."
"Good,"
Jem said. "Don't."
His heart was hammering and he felt sweaty, but his hands were going cold and hot and cold again. He'd got away by the skin of his teeth, diving under the bushes planted at the top of the spillway, and crawling down the concrete edging till he found a ladderway that went down into the water. He'd shuggled down it as far as he could, and clung on so hard his hands went numb with the black water rumbling inches under his feet, and surging down the spillway past him, drenching him with cold spray. He could still feel his bones shake with it. He believed he might throw up if he thought about it any more, so he turned away and went to look into the wee girl's toy chest. It was full of girly toys, of course, but maybe if they had a ball. They did. It was pink, but one of the good, high, bouncy kind.
"We could go out to the garden, maybe, and have a bit of catch," he suggested, bouncing the ball on the floor and catching it.
"It's dark and raining like the clappers," Tisha said. "Dinna want to get wet."
"Ach, it's no but a soft drizzle. What you made of, sugar?"
"Yes," said Sheena with a simper. "Sugar and spice and everything nice. That's what little girls are made of. Snips and snails and puppy dog tails."
"Come and play dollies," suggested Tisha, waggling a naked doll invitingly at him. "You can have G.I. Joe if you want. Or would you rather Ken?"
"Nay, I'm no playing dollies," Jem said firmly. "Can't I be doing with the clothes and all?"
"I play dollies."
Mandy muscled her way between Tisha and Sheena, eager hands stretched out for a Barbie in a pink frilly ball gown. Sheena grabbed it away just in time.
"Aye, aye,"
she soothed Mandy's impending screech.
"You can play, sure. You'll have to play nice, though. You dinna want to spoil her dress. Here, sit down, pet. I'll give you this one. See her wee comb and brush? You can fix her hair."
Jem took the ball and left. The upstairs hall had carpeting, but the landing was bare wood. He popped the ball off it, and it shot up and hit the ceiling with a smack, just missing the hanging light fixture. It bounced off the floor, and he caught it before it could get away, clutching it to his chest. He listened for a second, to be sure Mrs. Buchan hadn't heard. She was back in the kitchen, though. He could hear the sound of her singing along to the radio. He was halfway down the stairs when the bell over the front door went, and he looked over the banister to see who it was coming in. Who it was Rob Cameron. And Jem nearly swallowed his tongue. Jem pressed himself back against the wall of the landing, his heart pounding so loud he could barely hear Mrs. Buchan come out of the kitchen. Should he go get Mandy? There wasn't any way out of the house but by the stairs. He couldn't drop Mandy out the lounge window. There wasn't a tree or anything. Mrs. Buchan was saying hello, and she was sorry if the gentleman was wanting a room because she was booked full every day this week. Mr. Cameron was being polite, saying, "No, thank you kindly. He was only wondering, might he have a wee word?" "If you're selling anything," she started, and he interrupted her.
"No, missus, nothing like that. It's a few questions I have about the stones at Craignadoon."
Jem was gasping for air. His lungs were heaving, but he'd pressed a hand over his mouth so Mr. Cameron wouldn't hear. Mrs. Buchan didn't gasp, but he could hear her take breath, then stop, deciding what to say.
"Stones," she said,
and even he could tell she was faking puzzlement.
"I dinna ken anything about stones."
Rob made a polite laugh.
"I apologise, missus. I should have introduced myself first. My name's Rob Cameron, and is something wrong, missus?"
She'd not only gasped really loud, Jem thought, she must have stepped back without looking and hit the wee table in the hall, because there was a thump and an "ach," and the splat of picture frames falling over.
"No,"
Mrs. Buchan said, getting a hold of herself.
"No, had a wee turn, that's all.
I've the high blood pressure, Ken. Get that wee bit dizzy. Your name's Cameron, is it?"
"Aye, Rob Cameron. I'm cousin by marriage to Becky Weems. She told me a bit about the dancing up at the Stones."
"Oh?" That "oh" meant trouble for Becky Weems, thought Jem, who knew a lot about mother's voices.
"I'm a bit of a scholar of the old ways, see? I'm writing a wee book. Anyway, I wondered if I could maybe talk to you for a few minutes. Becky said you'd know more about the Stones and the dancing than anybody else."
Jem's breathing slowed down once he realised that Mr. Cameron hadn't come because Mr. Cameron knew Mandy and he were here. Or maybe he did. and was trying it on with Mrs. Buchan till he could make an excuse to use the loo and come poke round in search of them. He looked apprehensively up the half-flight of stairs that led from the landing, but the lounge door above was closed, and while he could hear Mandy's giggling fine through it, probably Mr. Cameron couldn't. Mrs. Buchan was taking Mr. Cameron back to the kitchen. Her voice, when she'd said, "Come, Ben, I'll tell you what I can," hadn't sounded at all friendly. Jem wondered whether she might be going to put rat poison in Mr. Cameron's tea. Maybe Mrs. Buchan didn't have any rat poison, though. He took a step one way, then the other, then back. He really, really wanted to run down the stairs and out the door and keep going. But he couldn't leave Mandy. His havering stopped at once when the kitchen door opened, but he could hear it was Mrs. Buchan's step, and just hers, coming fast and light. She turned up the stairs, but started back when she saw him on the landing, a hand to her chest. Then she ran up to him and hugged him tight, whispering in his ear. "Bloody heck, lad, what you—" "Well, never mind. I was coming to find you. You saw him?" Jem nodded wordless, and Mrs. Buchan's mouth pressed flat. "Aye, I'm going to take you out the door. Go left out the gate. 2 houses down is Mrs. Kelleher. Knock and tell her I sent you to use the phone. You call the police and tell them the man that kidnapped you is here. You ken the address here." He nodded. He'd seen the number when he visited before with Mam and Dad, and remembered it because it was 669. Dad had said it should by rights be 666, but that was the number of the beast. Jem had asked whether it was Mr. or Mrs. Buchan that was the beast, and Mam and Dad both laughed like loons. "Good," said Mrs. Buchan, letting go of him. "Come on, then." "Mandy," he started, but she shushed him. "I'll mind her. Come." He ran down the stairs after her, trying not to make any noise, and at the door she stood on her toes and held the little bell so it wouldn't ring. "Run," she whispered. He ran. Mrs. Kelleher was an old lady and kind of deaf. Jem was out of breath and so scared he couldn't put his words together right, so it was a long time before she took him to the telephone. And then the lady at the police station put the phone down on him twice because she thought he was some Bampot Wayne who'd got hold of the phone and was playing tricks. "I'm Jeremiah Mackenzie," he bellowed next time she answered. "I was kidnapped."
"You were?" said Mrs. Kelleher, very startled. She grabbed the phone away from him.
"Who's this?"
she demanded of it. Faint squawking. At least the police lady hadn't hung up again. Mrs. Kelleher turned and squinted through her spectacles at him.
"Who was it you were wanting to call, lad? You've got the police by mistake."
He really wanted to hit something, but he couldn't hit Mrs. Kelleher. He said something very bad in Gaelic, and her mouth fell open. She'd let the phone fall away from her ear, though, and he grabbed it.
"The man that kidnapped me is here," he said, as slow as he could. "I need somebody to come before..."
Inspiration struck.
"Before he hurts my little sister. It's 669 Glenarcut Road. Come right away."
Then he put the phone down before the lady could ask him questions. Mrs. Kelleher had plenty of those, and he didn't want to be rude, so he asked, could he use the loo, and locked the door against her, then hung out the upstairs window watching for the police. Nothing happened for what seemed forever. The raindrops started to drip off his hair and eyelashes, but he was afraid of missing anything. He was rubbing the water out of his eyes when all of a sudden the door of 669 flew open and Rob Cameron came running out, jumped in a car, and drove off with the tyres squealing. Jem almost fell out the window, but then rushed back and barreled out of the bathroom, nearly knocking Mrs. Kelleher over.
"Thank you, Mrs. Kelleher," he yelled over his shoulder, taking the stairs 3 at a time, and shot out the front door.
There was a lot of screaming and crying going on inside the Buchan's house, and he felt his chest go so tight that he couldn't breathe.
"Andy,"
he tried to call, but her name came out in a whisper. The front door was hanging open. Inside there were girls everywhere, but he picked Mandy out of the muddle in the lounge instantly and ran to grab her. She wasn't crying, but she latched onto him like a leech, burying her black curly head in his stomach.
"It's okay," he told her, squeezing the stuffing out of her in relief. "It's okay, man. I gotcha. I gotcha."
His heart started to slow down a little, and he saw that Mrs. Buchan was sitting on the sofa, holding a towel full of ice cubes to her face. Some of the ice had fallen out and was lying on the rug at her feet. Tisha and Sheena were holding on to their mother and crying, and Ginger was trying to pat her mam's hair and comfort her sisters at the same time, but her face was dead white, and tears were running silently down it.
"Mrs. Buchan, are you all right?" Jem asked timidly.
He had an awful feeling in the bottom of his stomach. Somehow, he was sure this was his fault. Mrs. Buchan looked up at him. One side of her face was puffy, and the eye on that side was swollen half shut. But the other had fire in it, and that made him feel a little better.
"Aye, fine, Jim," she said. "Dinna fash, girls. It's well enough. No but a black eye. Quit your caterwauling, will you? I canna hear myself think."
She gave a small, good-natured shake to detach the clinging girls, pushing and patting at them with her free hand. Then there was a knock at the door jamb, and a man's voice from the front hall.
"Police here. Anyone to him?"
Jem could have told Mrs. Buchan what happened once you called the police. Questions, questions, and more questions. And if there were things you couldn't tell the police. At least Mrs. Buchan wouldn't let them take Jem or her to the police station to answer questions, insisting that she couldn't leave the girls on their own. By the time the police gave up, Mandy and Sheena were both asleep on the couch, curled up together like a pair of kittens. And Ginger and Tisha had made everyone tea, then sat yawning in the corner together, blinking now and then to keep awake. A few minutes after the police left, Mr. Buchan came home for his supper, and all the explaining was to do all over again. There really wasn't much to it. Mrs. Buchan had sat Mr. Cameron down in the kitchen and told him a bit about the dancing. It wasn't a secret. Most folk who lived in Inverness for a long time knew about it. But she'd left the radio playing while they were talking, and all of a sudden the newscaster was saying the name Robert Cameron, and how Robert Cameron was wanted for questioning in the kidnapping of a local boy, and then the wee bastard jumps up, and so do I. And he must have thought I meant to stop him. I was betwixt him and the door, any road. And he belts me one in the eye, pushes me into the wall, and he's away off. Mr. Buchan was giving Jem a hard look now and then, and seemed like he wanted to start asking questions. But instead, he said they'd all go into the town and have a fish supper, as it was so late. And everyone started feeling better at once. Jem could see the looks going back and forth between the Buchans, though. He kind of wondered whether Mr. Buchan might mean to drop him and Mandy off at the police station on the way back. Or maybe just leave them by the side of the road. Chapter 39 The Ghost of a Hanget Man. The heavens opened, and Roger was soaked to the skin by the time he got back to the McLaren's cottage. Amid cries of dismay from Mrs. McLaren and her ancient mother, he was hastily stripped, wrapped up snug in a ragged quilt, and stood to steam before the fire, where his presence greatly impeded the preparations for supper. Buck, propped up on pillows with the two smallest McLarens curled up in sleep on the bed beside him, lifted a brow at Roger in inquiry. Roger moved his hand slightly in a tell-you-later gesture. He thought Buck looked better. There was colour in his face, and he was sitting upright, not slumped into the bedding. For a brief instant, Roger wondered what would happen if he were to lay his own hand on Buck. Would it glow blue? The thought sent a shiver through him, and Allie, One of the McLaren daughters pushed the trailing edge of his quilt away from the fire with a squeak of alarm.
"Take care, sir, do."
"Aye, do," said Granny Wallace, pulling the blackened iron spider, this spitting hot grease, well away from his bare legs, and making shooing motions.
"Take a spark and you'll go up like tinder."
She was blind in one eye, but the other was sharp as a needle and gave him a piercing look.
"Tall as ye are, ye'd likely set the roof tree afire. And then where should we all be, I'd like to know?"
There was a general titter at that, but he thought the laughter had an uneasy note to it, and wondered why.
"Moran tank,"
Roger said, in polite thanks for the advice. He moved a foot or so farther from the hearth, fetching up against the settle on which Mr. Angus McLaren was sitting, mending his pipe stem.
"Since ye speak of roof trees, there's a wee croft just over the hill that's been burnt out. Cooking accident, was it?"
The room went silent, and people froze for an instant, all looking at him.
"Evidently not,"
he said with an apologetic cough.
"I'm sorry to make light. Were folk killed then?"
Mr. McLaren gave him a brooding sort of look, quite at odds with his earlier geniality, and set the pipe on his knee.
"No, by the fire," he said. "What led you up there, man?"
Roger met McLaren's eyes directly.
"Searching for my lad," he said simply. "I dinna ken where to look, so I look everywhere, thinking, what if he's got away? What if he's wandering about by himself? Maybe taking shelter where he can find it."
McLaren took a deep breath and sat back, nodding a little.
"Aye, well, you want to keep well away from that croft."
"Haunted, is it?" Buck asked, and all heads swung round to look at him, then swung back to Mr. McLaren, waiting for him to give the answer.
"It might be,"
he said, after a reluctant pause.
"It's cursed,"
Ally whispered to Roger under her breath.
"You didn't go in, sir, did you?"
said Mrs. McLaren, the permanent worry crease deepening between her brows.
"Och, no,"
he assured her.
"What was it happened there?"
McEwen hadn't any hesitation about going into the croft. Did he not know whatever they were concerned about? Mrs. McLaren made a small noise, and with a shake of her head, swung the cauldron out on its bracket and began to scoop out boiled neeps with a wooden spoon. "Not her place to speak of such goings-on," said her primly sealed mouth. Mr. McLaren made a somewhat louder noise, and leaning forward, got ponderously to his feet.
"I'll just be going to check the beasts before supper, Ken,"
he said, and gave Roger an eye.
"Perhaps you'd like to come along and be oot the way of the lasses and their doings?"
"Oh, aye," Roger said, and with a small bow to Mrs. McLaren, hitched the quilt up higher over his shoulders and followed his host into the byre. He caught Buck's eye in passing and gave him a brief shrug. In the usual way, the cattle's quarters were separated from the people's by no more than a stone wall with a large space at the top, allowing the considerable heat, along with floating bits of straw and a strong scent of piss and manure, generated by several large cows, to percolate into the ben. The McLaren's was a snug byre, well kept, and piled with clean straw at one end, with three fat, shaggy red cows, and a diminutive black bull who snorted fiercely at Roger, nostrils red-black in the dim light, and the brass ring in his nose agleam. The ben of the croft was far from cold, what with nine people crammed into it, and a good peat fire on the hearth. But the byre was filled with an encompassing warmth and a sense of peace that made Roger sigh and drop his shoulders, only then realizing that they'd been up around his ears for what seemed hours. McLaren made no more than a cursory check of his beasts, scratching the bull between the ears and administering a comforting slap to a cow's flank. Then he led Roger to the far end of the byre with a jerk of his head. Ever since his conversation with Hector McEwen, Roger had had an uneasy feeling caused by something he felt he had heard and not understood. And now, as McLaren turned to speak to him, it was there suddenly, clear in his head. Cranesmuir.
Two strangers built the croft up there,
McLaren said. They came from nowhere, seemingly. Just one day they were there, a man and a woman, but we couldn't tell were they man and wife, or maybe a man and his daughter, for he seemed a good bit older than she did. They said they came from the Isles, and I think maybe he did, but her speech wasn't like any islander I've heard.
Was she Scots?
McLaren looked surprised.
Oh, aye, she was. She had the Gaelic. I'd have said she came from somewhere up northwest of Inverness, maybe Thurso. But there again, it wasn't quite right.
Not quite right, like someone out of their proper place, pretending. What did she look like?
Roger said. His voice was thick. He had to clear his throat and repeat himself. McLaren's lips pursed, but not in condemnation. It was the sort of soundless whistle of appreciation one gives at sight of something remarkable.
Bonny, he said.
Very bonny indeed. Tall and straight, but not so straight in places, if you take my meaning.
He ducked his head, half embarrassed, and Roger realized that his reluctance to talk in front of the womenfolk perhaps wasn't due entirely to the scandalous nature of his story.
I do,
Roger said, lowering his own voice to McLaren's confidential level.
Did they keep to themselves, then?
If they hadn't, surely the whole district would have known about them, and quickly discovered whether they were man and wife. McLaren frowned.
Aye, they did. Though he was friendly enough. I met him now and again out on the moor, and we'd have a word, and I'd always come away thinking as how he was a good wee fellow. And yet, when I came to tell my Maggie about it, I couldn't just charge my memory with anything he'd said.
McLaren said somehow word got round that the woman was something that wee bit odd.
A root doctor?
But maybe would give you a bit more than a grass cure, if you found her alone in the house.
There was no light in the byre, save the dull glow from the hearth-fire next door, but even so Roger could see that McLaren had grown flushed and discomfited. Roger was beginning to feel uncomfortable himself, but not for the same reason.
Cranesmuir.
He knew the name, had known it when McEwen said it. The McLarens had said the healer came from Drochanach. Cranesmuir was in the opposite direction, and 2 miles further on. Why was he going there tonight?
There were stories, always are, about a woman like that,
McLaren cleared his own throat.
But she was good with the grass cures, and with charms as well. Or so folk said.
But then the man had gone, McLaren said. No one knew where. They just didn't see him any more. And the woman went on as before. But now more of her visitors were men. And the women stopped taking their bairns up there, though they'd go sometimes themselves, quietly, in secret. And then, on the day before Samhain, as the sun was sinking and the great fires being built up for the evening, a woman from nearby had gone up to the lonely croft and run down again, screaming.
She'd found the door of the croft standing wide, the woman and her things all gone, and a man hanging from the roof tree, stone dead with a rope around his neck.
The shock tightened Roger's own throat. He couldn't speak. McLaren sighed, head bent. A cow had come up behind him, nudging gently. And he laid one hand on her back as though seeking support from the animal who went on.